KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Novelist Isabel Allende ventures into new territory with her latest book, Ripper, a mystery thriller set in San Francisco. The novel's young protagonist, Amanda Martin, investigates a slew of local murders that become personal after her mother goes missing. The author of magic realist novels like The House of the Spirits and The Infinite Plan, Isabel Allende joins us to discuss her foray into the world of whodunits, and that's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. With tens of millions of books sold in 29 languages, Isabel Allende is the world's most read Latin American writer, author of 11 works of fiction, including two novels, which became movies. She's also published four memoirs and three young adult novels. And now, with her new novel, Ripper, she has turned out her first thriller crime mystery novel. Set in San Francisco, Ripper is the story of a series of ritualized murders featuring a group of young people who play the online game that gives the novel its title as they search for clues and act like sleuths. And here with us in studio, Isabel Allende, welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael. You always have me here for every book, and I feel so grateful.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. You're fun to talk to, and people love you. And this is such a different book for you. I mean, it's a challenging book, I imagine, to write because you've never written anything like this before.
You know, I've tried several genres. I've tried historical novel, political novels, family sagas, a trilogy for young adults, memoirs. So every time there is a challenge. In this case, however, it was a fun challenge because, I don't know, I think that everybody has a fantasy of killing somebody sometime in their lives. That's why we love
Chris Rock says, especially people you're married to.
And, yeah, let me tell you, after all the research I did for this book, Willie, my husband, doesn't eat at home anymore. And he's always looking over his shoulder.
I read an interview you did where you said, the first thing I would take out in a fire would be my letters to and from my mother. No, make that the pets. Willie didn't get mentioned. But he does get mentioned in this novel a couple of times. I couldn't help but notice on page 90 suddenly, and he's been on it. We featured Willie Gordon, Isabel's husband, writes crime novels now. He's an attorney, longtime Bay Area resident. He's the reason she lives here. And Samuel Hamilton is mentioned almost near the end of the book. So the figure upon which the detective in Willie's novels is based, you've got publicity for Willie in your book.
Yeah, Willie's sleuth is a reporter called Samuel Hamilton. And when I was writing this book, all his novels are placed in the 60s. I have a detective that is called Samuel Hamilton and is the son of Willie's detective. So he didn't know that. And when he read the manuscript, he was so surprised and so delighted.
Well, I think that'll help your marriage. That's a good thing. But this is a different genre, and it's also kind of an interesting jump from Maya's Notebook. How do we go from Maya's Notebook to this? The last novel of yours we featured.
The truth, Michael, is that this wasn't my idea at all. I announced that I was going to retire in 2011, and my agent just panicked. I think that I support the agency all by myself. And she said, no, you have to write a book with your husband. So we tried with Willie. We really tried. But we ended up fighting like dogs. We have very different styles. He writes in English. I write in Spanish. His attention span is more or less 11 minutes. And mine is 11 hours. So I would end up writing the book and he would get half the credit. So it wasn't very convenient for me. We decided that that was not going to work. He went to his room to write his sixth novel, and I went to mine to try my first one.
And the truth is, you're keeping your agent afloat with this. This is it's a gripping mystery, though, and it's really well done. C.P. Snow, the famous scientist and novelist, once said, if you can write a mystery novel, you can write any kind of novel. You had to come a long way before you got to a mystery novel. But it hooked me early and kept me engaged. And I want to talk to you about the details of the novel. But it's also a mother-daughter story and a very, anyways, engaging story about a mother and daughter who couldn't be more different.
All my books are about characters and relationships more than plot. And, of course, in a mystery, plot is what is important. But when Willie started reading my book, and many people who have already read Ripper say that it's just one of my books, and I threw in there a few corpses. But it's like all my other novels. It's about relationships. And so I'm more interested in the character of the mother, the character of the villain, the character of the Navy SEAL, my sleuth, Amanda, who is a kid, 16 years old. I like people more than the plot.
You've also got a nice triangle. You mentioned the sleuth. He is one suitor for the mother in the story. And,
the Navy SEAL, not the...
The Navy SEAL is one of the suitors, along with a fellow who is very wealthy, has a Woodside estate and a Napa place.
Well, he's a trust fund baby.
Yeah, exactly.
We know so many of those in this part of the world.
Well, you've got, in fact, this is a very local story in many ways. Samuel T. Paler Park is mentioned, Pacific Heights, Potrero Hill, North Beach. I mean,
it's San Francisco.
It is San Francisco, yeah. You've even got the Dolphin Club in here. it's fun for local writers, for local readers to just realize how close to home a lot of this is. You've also got, I want to get into the plot to some extent, but you've also got a lot of other things in here that very much are in the zeitgeist and the air we breathe. I just made a little list. Let me go through some of them. Munchausen syndrome, female genital mutilation, holistic healing, post-traumatic stress, the Sunyenos, dogfights, transsexuality, illegal immigration, aromatherapy. Wow! It's a cornucopia.
And that's just a little bit of it.
Yeah, I just got a snatch of it, exactly. I mean, you put so much into even this novel of relationships, of just stuff that you kind of absorb and take in as a novelist. It's a big canvas.
Well, when I started the book, the first day, my husband, Willie, called me for a glass of wine at 7 o'clock, and he said, "How was your day?" And I said, "Oh, great. I had a great day today. I could describe San Francisco, North Beach, the coffee shops, this and that and that." And he said, "No, this is a mystery. You need a corpse in the first page." And I realized that I had spent a lot of time creating the atmosphere, the theater where my characters would move. And that's what I do with every novel.
So you admit to deferring to Willie and getting a corpse in there early?
Yes, I had to get a corpse very early on.
Well, there's also an astrologer in this novel, and it prompted me to think about just how much stock you put in astrology, if any. Because a lot of the murders are
related to
astrology, yeah.
Yeah. Although there's much in the book that is tongue-in-cheek, I've been accused of writing magic realism for 30 years.
Accused.
Yeah. And now that all this happens in San Francisco, it's not magic realism. It has another name. But it's the same stuff. I have a holistic clinic that if it was in Chile, it would be some witch's den or something. And I have an astrologer called Celeste Rocco who predicts a bloodbath in San Francisco. And the kids that are playing the game, the role-playing game Ripper, challenge the astrologer. They want to prove that she's wrong, that she cannot predict anything. And so that's how the story begins.
And talk about these kids. This is quite a little tribe, to use a word that you often use about your family and extended family. There are kids all over the world using, the media the kids use nowadays.
Yeah, these are five kids and a grandfather that play a role-playing game online called Ripper. And actually, the game exists. And it's about hunting Jack the Ripper in London, 1888. And I saw my granddaughter, Andrea, playing the game. And that gave me the idea for the book, because I thought, if I can put all this action in San Francisco, 2012, I will have my sleuth be these young kids. And in a role-playing game, each player creates a character that represents them. And that character has skills and limitations. And with those skills and limitations, they have to play the role.
Is there a little bit of a celebration of the new world of the Internet? Because you've been critical about it. I mean, you've said on a couple of occasions that technology is taking over the lives of young people. And obviously, to some degree, it certainly is.
Yeah, I think that I saw my granddaughter and the kids in general constantly connected to a phone or to something. They cannot be without it. And very young, they start living in a sort of virtual digital world in which real human connections become harder and harder because you never get to see people in the eye, look at people in the eye. So, but on the other hand, technology is wonderful. The fact that the world is connected, communicated, informed, everything moves so fast now.
Talking with Isabel Allende, her new novel is Ripper, and you mentioned the grandfather. The grandfather, Blake Jackson, also known as Cable, is it, or Cable?
Yeah, Cable.
Cable, which is a
anagram
of Blake, yeah. I mean, at various times, I don't want to give away too much here, but the grandson will say, granddaughter will say, or he'll say, "Do you love me?" Say, "Do you love me?" I say, "Nope."
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, it's an interesting little repartee that they have back and forth, as if they want to be different, but at the same time, again, the
they
tongue is in
other.
The cheek.
Yeah,
know?
They love each other.
Of course
other.
They do.
And,
yeah.
And the grandfather is devastated because the girl will go to college very soon, and he has brought her up.
MIT, in fact.
Yeah, so he's really distressed at the idea that he will lose her. As I was when my grandchildren went to college. And the relationship that that grandfather has with Amanda is very much like the one I thought I had with my grandkids.
But you thought you had?
Yeah, because they're now all gone to college and they don't talk to me. I have to find out if they're still alive on Facebook.
Or when they need a check like your agent or something like that. I'm going to ask you to read something from Ripper, but before I do, you were talking about tongue firmly in cheek or whatever, and there was one point when I found myself thinking, this is Isabel Allende and the wonderful sense of humor that you have. It was early on. It was about the grandchild, Amanda, one of the major sleuths in the group. When she turned 13, Amanda discovered that her godmother was not, in fact, infallible. The planets had apparently decided that Amanda should go to a public school, but Encarnación Martín, her formidable paternal grandmother, insisted she attend a Catholic boarding school. For once, Amanda sided with Celeste, since a co-ed school seemed slightly less terrifying than being taught by nuns. But Doña Encarnación triumphed over Celeste Rocco by producing a check for the tuition fees. Little did she suspect that the nuns would turn out to be feminists in pants who challenged the Pope and used science class to demonstrate the correct use of a condom with the aid of banana. That encapsulates a lot of your sense of humor, doesn't it?
No, that encapsulates nuns today.
Well, and that as well, perhaps. But there's that, you know, irreverent. Of course, we have a different pope now, too.
Yeah, a wonderful pope.
So you read something for us from Ripper.
Do you want me to read 40 seconds or 2 minutes?
Whatever you want.
No,
your
whatever
choice.
You want. It's your program. You tell me.
Well, give us a little what you think maybe represents the book more in terms of the flavor of it or the tone of it. Or
okay. Yeah. This is one of the crimes. Rachel Rosen sensed something behind her, a shadowy presence like a bad memory. She stood motionless, engulfed by the same fear she had felt in the garage. She tried to control her imagination. She did not want to end up like her mother, who had spent her last years locked in her apartment, never going out, convinced the Gestapo were waiting on the other side of the door. "Old people get scared," she concluded, "but I'm not like my mother." She thought she heard a rustling of paper or plastic and turned towards the kitchen door. She could make out a shadow in the doorway, a blurred, bloated, faceless figure moving slowly and awkwardly like an astronaut on the moon. A hoarse, terrible howl came from the pit of her stomach, surging up through her chest like a blazing fire. She saw the fearsome creature advance toward her. A second scream stuck in her throat, and she ran out of air. Rachel Rosen stepped backward, bumped into the table, and fell sideways, shielding her head with her arms. She lay on the floor, begging in a whisper for him not to hurt her, offering money and anything else of value in the house. Trembling, she crawled under the table and curled up, bargaining and weeping for the 3 never-ending minutes she was still conscious. She did not even feel the pinprick of the needle in her thigh.
Vivid. Graphic writing. That's Isabel Allende reading from her new novel, Ripper. You wrote this in Spanish, though.
Yes. My problem, Michael, is that this novel should have been written in English. The characters are Americans. It happens in San Francisco. I did all the research in English, and then I had to translate all that into Spanish, and then the translators had to translate it back into English. There's a lot of work.
Talk about the research. This is written around the time of the Joseph Nassau trial, the serial killer who was tried in Marin County.
Yeah. But that was not the inspiration. What really helped me in the research was Book Passage, the wonderful bookstore that we have in Marin County. Every year, they have a mystery writers conference. And I had never attended the conference because I was not interested in the genre. But this time I did. They have an extraordinary faculty. You have detectives, policemen, a doctor that specializes in forensic medicine. Anything, any question you ask, somebody will be there to answer it. And then the questions of the students also gave me lots of ideas. The students are usually women, sometimes often middle-aged women, the nicest people in the world who only talk about murder. So that helped me for the research. But then I also found real people that I could use as models for my characters, like the Navy SEAL or the healer.
And did you do some research about suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge? Because I found myself fascinated by the fact there's a little detail in there about people going toward the bay rather than the water out of fear of sharks.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. You know, I make up a lot of stuff. Don't believe everything I say, Michael.
It reminds me of when you first met, I think it was Pablo Neruda who said, no, you shouldn't be a journalist, you should be a novelist because you make so much
I throw statistics here and there, but that doesn't mean anything. I just make them up.
Well, 73% of writers do that, I think. Are most therapists New York Jews who are also practicing Buddhists? I think that's also something you have in here.
No, that's not invented. Look around.
That's observational or repertorial. And did you look into, because you have this Navy SEAL who was supposedly involved in the raid on Abbottabad and the killing of Osama bin Laden?
Well, actually his team is. He wasn't himself, but his team was. And actually I was very, very lucky because a friend of mine's cousin is a retired Navy SEAL who had just retired, and he was willing to talk to me. So I went to Washington and spent 3 days with him and sucked his blood like a vampire. So the body language, the haircut, the photographs he showed me, the medals, the stories, the everything. Everything is in the book.
Including the war dog Attila or something?
He didn't have that dog, but somebody else had the dog. When I went to Washington in the book tour, I met him again, and he was there. He couldn't identify himself in the audience, but he was there, and he came over, and he was pleased with the book, and he was very generous.
And the book takes us into really a lot of darkness, too. I mean, how did that affect you? I mean, not to say that you haven't dealt with subjects that are certainly questions of evil and darkness in the past and everything, but this much more profoundly, as in the excerpt that you read about Rachel Rosen.
You know, the book that really affected me physically, the darkness that most hit me, and it somehow stays with me, was when I researched for Island Beneath the Sea. And that is about slavery. Mm-hmm. Slavery 200 years ago in Haiti, but slavery in general. And that's something that somehow hurt me forever. I will always carry the scars because I discovered the awful things that people can do to other people when they have power and impunity. They're not accountable. And the worst scenario is the master and the slave. So this, although here we have crimes and some of this is very dark, it's still a crime novel. I'm making it up. It doesn't have the horrible weight of reality that slavery had.
Understood, but your imagination certainly delves into. I mean, the opening murder is a pretty brutal and I don't know if I want to go into detail here. Or just it's a murder that involves, let's say, a baseball bat, and I'll leave it to the imagination of listeners as to where that baseball bat wound up. But It's graphic, it's vivid, and you must have had it pretty locked into your consciousness.
Yeah, but it's easy to let go because I'm making it up, and it's a novel. It's a, you know, in a mystery, there is a sort of agreement that we have that we are reading, no matter how gruesome it is, it's still fiction. It's not real. How can people read the Stieg Larsson novels, for example, that are really brutal? or Joe Nesbo, because they know that it's not true. It's a sort of formula that we all agree upon.
You read those writers and they influenced you?
Well, I had not read them before, but when I started writing this, those were the novels that everybody was reading. So I read a couple and I thought, my God, I can never write like this. It's first of all, it's very Scandinavian. And then there's such darkness, such horror that I can't deal with that. And here, of course, the murders are pretty bad. But the people are full of light and redemption and love and there's.
It's more American and perhaps Latin American fused novel, hybrid of the two. Would you say?
I would say.
I mean, that's your sensibility after all. But there is something also, in many ways, American about this novel. More than, I mean, writers like Bharati Mukherjee come to mind. You know, who establish themselves like you have in the United States and insist on being seen. They want to be seen as American writers. When you were talking about, yes, I wrote it in Spanish. I almost sound like. Slightly apologetic because it's set in San Francisco.
No. Only in this case because it is set in San Francisco and it should have been written in English. But I know that I'm Latin American. I will always be a foreigner in this country. And I'm glad about that because I'm never too comfortable. I don't take anything for granted. I'm always asking questions. And in those questions, I find the stories. Most people who are very comfortable where they live don't have that feeling of awe that I have always. I mean, I open the faucet in my bathroom and hot water comes out, and I'm in awe.
Linda Ronstadt was on earlier this week. Just wanted to get your thoughts about this, and she was talking about her devotion to and her passion to working with undocumented people, illegal immigrants, you know, however they're described. And the opportunity that America affords them and so forth. I know this has been an important cause to you. And she was saying it should go both ways. Americans maybe should go to Mexico and they should be welcome there. They're not. Illegal people going into Mexico are given a much harder time than they are, one could argue, in this country.
It's numbers also.
Of course. It's not, and the people coming here fleeing over the border from not only Mexico, Guatemala, and most of the countries in Latin America. But what about your attitude now toward, because I know this has been a cause for you, toward accepting and giving amnesty and so forth?
I'm all for it. All for it. First of all, they are here. Their children have been born here. This country was made with immigrants, and every wave of immigrants has been badly received in this country. The people that were least respected were the Irish or the Jews or the Arabs, or the Italians when they came. And they all integrated and they are part of the society today. And the same will happen with Latinos. And they have contributed to this country in the 26 years that I've lived here. Everything has changed. We have Latino music, Latino restaurants everywhere, Mexican or Peruvian or whatever they are. People are voting now. They have political power that they didn't before. So all that needs to be taken into account and incorporated, and it's wonderful. It enriches the society. It doesn't make it any less. It makes it more. And then the other thing is that I'm asked often this question. As an immigrant, how do you cope with being in a foreign land? Well, you take the best from both worlds. You don't have to choose. Take it all.
Join us with Isabel Allende. Toll-free number available to you right now, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with novelist Isabel Allende. Her new book is called Ripper, and she's venturing into new territory with this book. It's a mystery thriller, which is set in San Francisco. The novel's young protagonist, Amanda Martin, investigates a slew of local murders that become personal after her mother goes missing, and the author of such allegedly magical realist novels as The House of the Spirits and The Infinite Plan of Love and Shadows. She is here, and we welcome your involvement in the program. In fact, let me again invite you to join us with any thoughts that are on your mind. I know there are many fans of Isabel Allende's, an opportunity to talk to a leading writer and also maybe to hear what some of you have to say about mystery novels, maybe even particularly mystery novels set in San Francisco. If there are any that come to mind that you particularly like, or if you want to talk about just the whole genre of writing a mystery novel, which was a mystery probably one could assert, at least in part, to Isabel Allende, though she, by osmosis, got a lot living with Willie Gordon, her husband who writes them. You may want to talk about the genre, and also may want to talk about immigration, which I brought up right before we went to that break. She'll be speaking at Books, Inc. At an event on Sunday, February 9th at noon at the Chapel in San Francisco, and a big event tonight, and I understand there are still actually a few tickets left at Angelica Hall at Dominican University. You can buy tickets on bookpassage.com and spend the evening with Isabel Allende at 50 Acacia Avenue in San Rafael. It's tonight at 7 p.m. And you can also join us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or join us in a number of other ways by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Think you were influenced by Willie's novels?
No, I don't think that I was influenced by his novels, but I was the fact that we talk about murder all the time in bed helps.
And this is breakfast conversation.
Yeah. So,
well, he talks to you about his plots.
Yeah,
and you talk to him about this plot.
We share ideas and stories, but I don't read his books until they are published, and he doesn't read mine. During the process or the manuscript, I give him the manuscript, but it's in Spanish, and it takes him some time to read it. By the time he finishes the book, usually it's halfway through the translation.
Who else reads your work before it goes to print? Nobody?
Nobody. It goes to Spain. Before, my mother used to, but now my mother is 93, and she doesn't feel that she can edit my books. And in Spain, they have never corrected anything. Well, they correct the language because I end up writing as Willie speaks, which is not a good thing. So they correct that kind of stuff, but not the story, or they don't really do editing in the way American editors do.
So you said that before you wrote this novel, you were almost decided upon retirement. And what does that mean now for the future? I mean, are you going to continue writing books, or writing mystery books for that matter?
Well, actually, we have gone through a very bad time in our family. And I was feeling down, very down. Not depressed, because I've never been really depressed, but down. I felt that I was
tired.
Excuse
me, you weren't depressed after Paula died?
No, I was very sad after Paula died.
Her daughter, I'm sorry. Yeah.
But depression is like a spiral down to hell. And it paralyzes you. You can't do anything. You can't get out of it without help. I was just very, very sad, as anybody who loses a child would be. But last year and the last 2 or 3 years have not been good. But now I'm sure that this year, 2014, is going to be splendid. And I am in the middle of a huge, long book tour. But I saved January 8th. Without any activity, so that I could write a few pages and leave the door open for a book that I will write when I finish the book tour at the end of February.
Always starts on January 8th, and I'm glad you're still writing.
Thank you.
Let me bring some callers in here. We go first to Rebecca. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Love the show. I'm a big fan of your work. I teach in Introduction to Literature at a community college, and every year I teach, and of Claire We Created, and Rolf, and the narrator, and Azucena, they just really stay with me, and every time I revisit that story, I feel they speak to me. I'm wondering if any of the characters that you write about have stayed with you, and do you ever wonder, how would Rolf report on this tragedy, or, you know, where is this character now?
Thank you, Rebecca, for calling. That story really happened. It happened to a little girl called Omaira Sanchez in Colombia. There was a landslide the mud completely buried a town. And reporters came from all over the world to report the tragedy. And they flew in helicopters and planes and whatever. And there was a little girl called Omaira Sanchez trapped in the mud up to her chest. And they could not fly in a pump to pump the water and save the girl's life. And for 3 days, the world watched the agony of this child until she died. And that story has stayed, of course, with me forever, and I still have the picture of the little girl. And some stories end up in my books, many. When I say that I'm a realistic writer, it's because these things happen. I just happen to put them in novels, and people think I make them up, but I don't.
And Rebecca, we thank you for the call. Well, you made a kind of tongue-in-cheek remark before about being labeled as a magic realist, but you have been for years, and in this new novel, Ripper, there's a reference to magic realism being passé.
Yeah.
Is it?
I don't know. It depends where you are. I mean, now Latin American writers abhor of magic realism because they don't want to be labeled like their ancestors, like Garcia Marquez and others. Why not? I mean, I love the idea that we don't have an explanation for everything, that the world is very mysterious, that everything is possible in my life and in my writing. Why would I limit myself to what I can explain, control, or buy?
But there are also American writers who would fit into that.
Absolutely. I mean, Toni Morrison.
Immediately comes to mind, yes.
Of course.
And we'll go to another caller, and that's Becca from Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say, Lisa Allende, that I used to read her books with my mom, who's now not with us, so I just wanted to thank her. It was really special for us. And my question is, I currently have a 12-year-old son, and he's, you know, obviously into video games and into mysteries and even into kind of some of the more edgy stuff. And I'm wondering if you thought it would be an appropriate book to read with him as a family.
Yeah, how old is he?
He's 12.
12. Well, I think that Ripper...
I don't think so.
I think that Ripper is not a young adult novel. Young adults can read it, but not at 12. I have other books like Sorrow that you could read.
Actually, you know what? In fact, she's written books for young adults.
Yeah, a trilogy for young adults. But Sorrow is a book that a family can read.
I think that's fine, yeah. And thank you, Becca, for the call. And by the way, I want you to... Some of you may have heard a low wailing sound before. I don't know what it was, but Dave sends an email saying the low wailing sound you just heard was thousands of male listeners heartbroken to hear that Isabel is married.
How cute. Thank you. If you would see me in person, this is not television, thank God.
Oh, come on. Stephen from San Rafael says, I too celebrate our history of immigration and am in favor of immigration reform, but I was wondering, does Isabel not make a distinction between legal and illegal immigration?
Yes, of course I make a distinction. But the illegal immigrants that are here have been here for years. And those who have not broken the law, who are hardworking people, need a chance. Why would they not be citizens of this country as other immigrants have been before them? This is a country open to that, made by immigrants. So I'm all for helping them become part of this society.
And I had mentioned before San Francisco mystery novels. I was wondering, have you read The Maltese Falcon, for example?
Of course. Yeah. Everybody has read that. Actually, and I've seen the movie like four times.
Yeah, it turns out we did a California reading series, and I was talking about it in a meeting just the other day. The most attention that we got in terms of listener response was that and Call of the Wild by Jack London.
Because
everybody's read them.
Of
exactly.
Course. In spite of, I think you read them in school.
There's... Well, let me get a caller on here. Neil's been waiting patiently. Neil, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, speaking of which, what's your opinion of Ross McDonald? Have you ever read him? Are there any other American detective writers you might have used as a model?
No, unfortunately, I haven't read much in this genre. Now I'm beginning to read. I thought that just because I was sleeping with a mystery writer, that would be enough training. But I realize that I have to read a lot of books.
Neil, thanks for the call. Well, we all have to read a lot of books. And yet the fact of the matter is that because you were down, I'm just trying to extrapolate from what you said earlier, you really were on the verge of retiring from writing. But writing has been your life, your adult life. I mean, could you really just have left it? In many ways, it elevates your spirit, I imagine.
It keeps me alive. Yeah. Keeps me engaged, curious. It connects me to people. And I hate the book tours because I hate traveling. But then it's the only opportunity I have of being face-to-face with my readers. And the feedback I get is so moving, so moving. Kids that have been named after characters of my books or after me or after Paula. People who met because they were both reading the same book. I mean, I get all kinds of wonderful stories. So that is so rewarding that I don't know why I was thinking I could stop writing. I must have been really bad.
Well, but this goes on all over the world. I mean, the kind of welcoming and the sort of excitement that people generate over your work and the laudatory remarks you get and, frankly, a kind of almost worship and devotion to you. And, you know, I say these kinds of things because I know that you don't have one of these egos like many writers have. You know, Woody Allen used to say about Norman Mailer, who I loved interviewing also and I think did 5 interviews with, you know, his ego was maybe the size of the continental United States. there's, you know, kind of modesty that you keep. And maybe it's because you keep yourself walled off and write so much as you do. Otherwise, this stuff could...
No, it's because I'm realistic.
Okay.
And I know that the people who come to me are the people who like me. But there are millions and millions out there that hate me. And they don't come. So why would I think that the world is made of people who like me? That's not true.
And those that hate you, why do you think they do?
Well, it's mainly other authors that sell less.
All right.
No, no, but
Schadenfreude.
But there's also critics and some people who don't agree with my political ideas. Right now, there's a huge controversy in Northern Carolina because the House of the Spirits was banned in one of the schools. It takes one parent to take a book out of the list, of the reading list of the kids. And this teacher, Mary Kent Whitaker, decided to make this her mission. And she has campaigned for the book. It's not about the book. It's about censorship. The reading the book is optional. The kids whose parents don't want them to read the book could read something else. But no, they want to ban it completely. They don't want any kid to read it. So,
but where do you decide on something like that? That's a whole can of worms and a fascinating topic. But we had someone say, is Ripper appropriate for a 12-year-old? And we kind of put the censor note down on it and said, probably not, right? There are books that are probably inappropriate. I'm not saying House of Spirits is one of them, but there was a lot of uproar about Maya Angelou's book, Now I Know Where the Cage Bird Sings, that it was inappropriate because it's about rape and molestation and those kinds of things.
What do you think do you think that kids don't know about that? Kids watch everything on television, on video games, in the movies. I went to see The Hunger Games. I had to get out. The violence was so horrible that I just couldn't stand it. Little kids watch that, and it's perfectly okay with the parents. But if there is sex, I know. Sex is the problem.
There are parents who want to protect their children not only from sex, but also from violence.
Well, those parents, if the teachers, if the Board of Education has put a book in the reading list, if a parent feels that they know better than all these people, okay, they can say, my kid will not read this book. If this is optional, my kid will read the Bible or whatever else. But no, they don't want anybody to read the book. And that kind of censorship is what I think we have to fight against.
There was a big brouhaha.
Oh, by the way, yeah. The House of the Spirits sales are soaring of course. In North Carolina. Yeah. Every kid is reading the book.
That's the way it is in the civilization we call America. By the way, do you mind hearing America? I had a student once from Peru, Comincha Benvenuto, in fact, from Miraflores, and those who know Lima, Peru, who said to me, why do you talk about American literature? We're all part of America. Mm-hmm. We should be talking about America as encompassing all of...
Or North American literature.
Yeah, or Canada and U.S. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, many people object to the fact that America means the United States, while we are all America. South America, Central America is also part of America.
That's exactly what she was objecting to, yeah.
Yeah, don't be so picky, though.
Can we talk a little bit about your foundation and the work you're doing?
Yeah, after Paula died, I wrote a book called Paula. And the income from that book and from all my other books has been feeding a foundation that I created to honor my daughter. And the mission of the foundation is empowerment of women and girls. And the truth is that I get all the credit, but the work is done by my daughter-in-law, Lori Barra. She runs the foundation. She visits every program. She travels to unbelievable places to find out what's going on. I mean, she does the work.
There was, for a while, a good deal of engagement on your part in the area of San Rafael, which is largely Hispanic. Also, I know you were working on behalf of literacy. I actually did something mm-hmm. with you years back on that score. I mean, You're spread out a lot in terms of just things that you believe in and do.
Well, all that is included in the mission of the foundation, because empowerment of women and children includes education, healthcare, and protection. And under those umbrellas, there is a lot that one can do. We don't invent anything, Michael. We just help financially organizations or programs that already exist and that are doing good work. And we evaluate each year the programs so we know where the money is and what we are doing with it.
In other words, you have metrics.
Yes.
And what are they?
Well,
I mean, how do you measure the work of a group that, for example, you're helping? Because we've talked a lot about philanthropy on the air,
okay,
and donors.
Let's say that we do homeless prenatal. And so we visit the place and we know that they have distributed 30,000 diapers. We visit the people who have been benefiting with it, how many people they are, how many clients they have, what happens with the clients after they have given birth, what happens with the babies. So we can evaluate. It's easy, actually.
Talking again with novelist Isabel Allende, and she'll be speaking at Books, Inc. on Sunday at noon at the chapel in San Francisco. She's also going to be speaking this evening as part of an event at Dominican College, and there's still tickets available, I'm told. Maybe only a few, but that's tonight at 7 o'clock. And you can buy tickets on bookpassage.com, and of course you can join us at our toll-free number at 866-733-6786.
By the way, in that event, you also get a book.
You get the copy of Ripper, yeah. What kind of advice? A lot of people go to Book Passage and try to learn how to be mystery writers. A lot of people set themselves up as wanting to be mystery writers. What kind of advice, after having written this novel, would you give to an aspiring mystery writer?
I wouldn't dare give advice, because this is my first mystery, and I learned so much at the conference that there's nothing else that I can contribute. Just attend the conference and keep writing and do it joyfully. You know, I said on a radio program or somewhere, maybe in an interview, that I had so much fun writing this, and I did it tongue-in-cheek, and that I couldn't take it really seriously. And then I got a huge diatribe of a woman in a blog complaining that if I was not taking this seriously, why would she buy my book? Well, I think that the writing is serious, the research is serious, but you have to write it playfully, with joy. Of course, it's killing, so that should not be joyful, but thinking about it is.
But you're also suggesting maybe this is a kind of what we call a tour de force. Huh?
In which sense?
I mean, the playfulness of it, the tongue-in-cheek quality, just what you've outlined.
My way of doing it. Other people do it in other ways. And I would say what I didn't do, unfortunately, read a lot of mystery writers and find your master, which is always a good idea. Follow the steps of your master, the person that you really like.
But you talk about the enjoyment you get out of writing, and yet you talk about the pain and the darkness of the novel about Haiti. That was not a joy to write, or was it?
The process of writing, of feeling that I am a medium, that the character of Sarité existed, and she wanted her story to be told, and she came to me in a dream, and she possessed me and forced me to write the story, that is joyful. Now the research, that 4 years of heavy-duty research, that's not fun.
And yet, I can't tell you how many writers have told me, Michael Chabon, for example, comes swiftly to mind, but many others. The research is really what's so fascinating. It's writing.
Oh, it's fascinating.
It's more onerous and more of the burden.
Love the writing, but the research depends on the theme, Michael. If I'm researching about corpses and autopsies and whatever, it's fun, because I'm never going to be confronted with that. But when I'm researching about absolute power, I'm afraid it can happen anytime, and I'm scared.
Power scares you? Absolute power scares you?
Yes.
Tell me how. Why?
Because it brings out the worst of people. People who feel that they have impunity can do anything. There are no moral restraints. And it happens in many levels. It's the brutal, drunken father who is the master in the house, and the children and the wife are terrified. He has absolute power, and he's not accountable. The power of the military in a military coup, the power of the troops that occupy a country, that kind of power, how can you control that?
I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Nobel Prize-winning author Isaac Bashevis Singer when I once said to him, I was talking about power of a novelist, and he said, that's not power. He said, Khomeini, that's power. You know?
Exactly.
But you do feel certain power as a novelist, don't you?
I feel that I'm giving something that I'm picking up something that is in the air and putting it in words, in a piece of paper, and then it goes out and touches people or makes people think. But that's not real power. Sometimes news on TV, an article in the press can have more power because it reaches more people.
Language has power, though, doesn't it?
Of course. That's why the first thing that any dictatorship or any repressive government does is control the language, change the words. When we had the military coup in Chile, you could not say the word compañero. You couldn't say the word pueblo, people, because all those were words that were attached to the socialist government. So the words were forbidden. The first people who were arrested were journalists and artists.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking to Isabel Allende. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. So for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to a couple of emails here. Sally says, I wanted to write in to say to Isabel Allende, I just read Maya's notebook. It was incredible. You are at the top of your game. I'm so sorry to hear you've been recently suffering. Please don't take writing more off the table. The life of your readers will be dimmed if you stop. I love your reading and all of your stories. And please
thank you. Thank you, Sally.
And John says, I'm curious about your thought processes. I recently read a book called The Mind's Eye, describing the ability of creative people to look at themselves and their environment from a place that is not simply behind their own eyes, but from a different point of view, even separated from their own self. Do you view your own self or your characters from another narrator point of view, and does it help with the creative process?
That's a very, very interesting thought. I had never thought about that. But actually, when I am writing, it's when people like me, because I'm not me.
Well, you're in an altered state of consciousness.
Yeah, I go into my casita, and then something happens, and I totally lose myself in the process of writing and creating these stories, and listening to the voices of the world that seem to be clamoring to be heard, and I completely lose myself. I'm not me anymore. Only when I come out after the process of writing a book, do I take a deep breath and I look at myself in the mirror and I say, oh, wow, here I am. You know, I meditate every morning. And for me, the easiest part of meditating is close my eyes and go to some place where I am not. There is no ego, there is no person, there is no memory, no thoughts. And that is the place where the stories are.
That's beautiful. How long do you stay there?
Usually very shortly in the morning, half an hour or whatever time I have.
But you need to go there.
That centers me.
Yeah.
And also, in a way, it centers me, and supposedly it should center me in my soul. But what happens is it opens the heart to everything that is happening outside me, which is much more interesting than myself.
Is there a soul?
Of course there's a soul. What a question.
Well, there are some who doubt it, as you know. They say it's never been anatomically accounted for or empirically accounted for.
Not everything that is accountable for exists. There are probably many dimensions of reality, many things that we have no idea that exist. Before they discovered radiation, it was still there.
Before they discovered bacteria, microbes, right?
They were still there, yeah.
Let me get a caller on. And Danielle, that's you. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Isabel, I'm so happy to hear you're not going to stop writing. Mm-hmm. I'm actually from Brazil. I've read all your books since I was 17, and now I'm 40, and I just moved here to San Francisco, and was so happy to hear that you live around here. Thank you so much for your writing. I have a really special relationship with Chile. I was raised by a Chilean nanny, and I'm looking forward to reading Ripper.
Thank you. I think that you will find San Francisco in Ripper, the city where you are living now.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Good luck to you, Danielle. Thank you for the call. I want to go up to Sebastopol and welcome Caroline. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I wanted to let Isabel know what an impact she had on me. I found a house parents in a garage build. It was a signed and autographed copy. And I was just I thought it was the coolest thing.
Caroline, I'm sorry, we're having some difficulty hearing you. It's a bad phone line, but I think she wanted to know what was the most difficult book for you to write. I think you've already.
Is that the question?
Yeah, that was the question. She was talking about you're signing a book for her, but you wanted to get to that question. Yeah.
The most difficult book to write, probably the second, because when you are successful with the first book, it's very hard to write the second one. The book that I wrote with tears was Paula, but that is the word that has. I mean, that is the book that has been the most important in my life. It has connected me with my readers in ways that no other book has.
Thank you for the call. Can you tell us what's next? You said you did a bit of writing on that
date.
No,
I can't.
Okay, don't. Ami writes, there's a real danger to blocking some books from being read by young readers. The book I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings saved my life when I read it as a young teenager who was being molested by a family member. I found out I was not alone, and it gave me the courage to get away from the situation in a safe way. I have friends who have been affected in a similar way by Miss Allende's books.
Thank you.
So much for censorship of any kind. Although, you know, there was a big brouhaha over Huckleberry Finn, of all things, because the N-word is used.
But you have to read the book. When the book was written, the context, the time in which the book was written, have that in consideration.
Well, you just keep selling in North Carolina, as we said.
Yeah.
Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank
you. It's always nice to see you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Jack Detch, Marissa Endicott, Mariam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Danielle Radin. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.